start. I would start. I mean, I think it's.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the City Council Chambers. It is 2 o'clock, and the day is Wednesday, November 9th, 2011. We are in afternoon session. Hi, Carla.
Hello.
Enjoying the fall color?
Yes.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It is.
Can you please call the roll?
Leonard. Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman. Adams.
Here. A quorum is present. We shall proceed. There's one item on the agenda, a non-emergency ordinance, time certain. Can you please read the title for item number 1198?
Amend the tax increment financing set aside for affordable housing policy to ensure continued development, preservation, and rehabilitation of housing affordable to households with incomes below 100% medium family income.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. And I'm going to invite Tracy Manning and her team to come forward. Mayor Adams and colleagues, this is Tracy's first presentation before council in her new position. So I know we will, she has a few butterflies. I know we will welcome her and treat her as an honored
normal
guest.
Normal hazing shall begin.
Before I begin my introductory remarks, I just want to thank Mayor Adams for being here at the beginning of this hearing. As everyone here knows, we would not have a 30% set-aside policy had he and Commissioner Leonard, among others, not been strong champions of this policy in 2006. Much of the success that we enjoy today is a result of his advocacy. But I will tell you that the mayor is here against the direction of Nurse Amanda Fritz because Mayor Adams is sick. And so what we've...
And I'm sitting next to him.
And remember, she's a psychiatric nurse. So she knows...
It's okay.
She knows problems when she sees it.
So what we agreed to do, if it's okay, is I will introduce the item. I will then turn to Mayor Adams for some brief opening remarks. And then I've asked Mayor Adams to go home and get into bed before the rest of us get to say. But it is a sign of how much he cares about this issue and how deeply involved he is in the issue that he's here. He did participate in council this morning, but by phone. So it means a lot to me as the housing commissioner that he's here. I'll tee it up, Mayor, turn to you, and then we'll excuse you. We will not be voting today, so it's a non-emergency matter. So the issue before us today is a review of the 30% set-aside policy for affordable housing. And when Tracy gives her presentation, she will be able to go deeper into the thank yous. But I want to begin by thanking former Director Margaret Van Vliet, Tracy Manning, Jacob, Alyssa, Mike Johnson, Kate Allen, David Chern, and the whole team that has worked so diligently on this issue. You've made me very proud as your housing commissioner. I also want to thank the committee members who served on the Stakeholder Review Committee, and I've asked Tracy during her presentation to actually identify them because they are a broad-based group of people, including many of the activists who originally either conceived of or advocated for a 30% set-aside. But the question I think we have to begin with is, why are we here today talking about this subject? And the answer, of course, has to do with the authorizing legislation that Commissioner Leonard and the mayor in particular had so much to do with in 2006. And when the 30% set-aside was created, there was a specific commitment that was embodied in the legislation that in the fifth year there would be a review of the policy. And that review would both be for the purpose of evaluating its success over the first 5 years and considering any changes based on experience. And so that's why we're here. And the proposal that you have before you is largely the work of the Stakeholder Review Committee that we put together. And as I said, that committee is largely composed of housing activists who have been deeply involved in both the creation and the implementation of this strategy. Before I highlight some of the successes, I want to thank our friends at the Portland Development Commission, who we'll be hearing from later, for the unusually high degree of cooperation and collegial relationship through this process. As everyone here knows, something funny happened on the way to this fifth-year review, and that was that housing was pulled out of the PDC and merged with the former BHCD, and we launched something called the New Portland Housing Bureau. So a number of the changes that are before council today are designed to address the structural changes which have occurred since the adoption of the policy in 2006. And it goes without saying that it now falls within the exclusive purview of the Portland Housing Bureau to continue to administer the 30% set aside with the full cooperation and assistance of the Portland Development Commission. So let's start with the good news. I think it's safe to say that in these trying times, we need good news. And so let's focus first on what we've accomplished in the first 5 years. Here are the key numbers, I think, that tell the story. Over $150 million in TIF, tax increment financing dollars, have been invested in affordable homes for people that our market does not serve over the first 5 years. That's an extraordinary commitment by this city. And in the past 2 years, almost $100 million of that invested in a number of signature projects. How have we done over the five-year period in the aggregate? Well, prior to the adoption of this policy, about 20% of TIF dollars were going into housing. Since the adoption of this policy, over the first 5 years, we are at 33%. That means that we have spent more dollars than the 30% floor, and we have outperformed. So $150 million for homes for people that need them the most, and 33% of all TIF dollars going to housing over that five-year period. That's pretty good news. But let's look at some of the specific signature projects that would not have happened but for TIF. Let's take the Bud Clark Commons. 130 units of affordable homes, shelter beds and services, the first of its kind in the country. It took $29.5 million of TIF for that project to launch. Let's take veterans housing in South Waterfront. I don't need to remind people how difficult it has been to move the affordable housing agenda in South Waterfront, but we've broken ground, and next year we will open the veterans housing complex, a substantial investment of TIF to make that happen. Let's look at our preservation agenda. When I took office, working with then-Director Will White, we made a commitment. Of the 11 affordable housing developments in downtown that were at risk of losing their federal subsidies between 2008 and 2013, Will and I said we would preserve each and every one of them. We called it the 11 by 13 campaign. Well, you know some of the projects that we've successfully saved because my colleagues have voted on them. Projects like the Admiral Apartments, which is on the north side of Director Park, 37 units of affordable homes for largely older, disabled, low-income residents, $3.7 million of TIF was the difference that allowed that project to move forward. Looking at our success on our preservation agenda over the last 3 years, we have successfully saved six buildings which were at risk, home to over 500 low-income tenants. And here's the kicker. As a result, we have preserved $50 million of federal subsidies over a 20-year period. That's the value of the project-based Section 8 vouchers, which we would have lost had those buildings gone to condos or market rent.
What was that number again?
$50 million is the cumulative value of the federal subsidies over a 20-year period in just those 500 units that we've already served. But the best is yet to come because we are working diligently to preserve the other five buildings. Now, that's the good news. And that would not have happened without a lot of intentional work, a lot of good collaborations, and a lot of hard work and dedication. Let's consider for a moment the challenges we face. TIF as a resource is going to have less value over the next 5 years. And it's not because of something nefarious. It's because districts are expiring, because we have front-loaded some of our spending, and because of compression. We will not spend $150 million over the next 5 years. It will be substantially less than that. And what's the lesson to those of us who care about providing homes for people the market doesn't serve? It is that we'll have to get serious about finding a replacement source of dedicated funding for the capital side of our work. That is our challenge looking forward. beyond the next five-year horizon. So with that as the context, we want to tell you a little bit about the work of the committee, what's before you, what constitutes change and what constitutes simply an extension of the existing practice, and why we believe the work of the stakeholder committee has brought us a better product today and something which will allow us to continue to successfully meet the needs of low-income tenants in our community. So it's my pleasure, for the first time officially, to welcome the new housing director for the City of Portland, Tracy Manning, to City Council. Before I do so, Mayor, could we ask for your comments?
It's hard to it's hard to fathom that it's been 5 years, because so much has been done and so much has been accomplished. The fact that we have leveraged as much outside funding as we have with TIF, the fact that with the establishment of the new bureau in a entrepreneurial with an entrepreneurial spirit, the fact that accountability and our partnerships are clearer now with the new bureau, those accomplishments are your accomplishments as Housing Commissioner, Commissioner Fish. And I wanted to let you know, as someone who, together we proposed the change, but as someone who had to leave it to you to make the change happen, how grateful I am, because it really is to get this kind of work out the door in such trying times and do a startup business, or in this case, a startup bureau. Those are amazing accomplishments, and I want you to know how much I appreciate it. I know others on the council appreciate it as well. And although my time on the council will expire in 14 months, I look forward to the discussions leading up to my retirement and as a member in the community of helping to find other resources, because among other things, what your work has shown and the work of your team has shown is that this really is, as you said, something the market on its own cannot and does not provide. And hitting that sweet spot of bringing resources to the table, but, you know, proposing projects that otherwise would never happen, you know, keeps Portland and keeps Portland what we want it to be, which is equitable. And we are focusing appropriately a lot in the last couple of months on racial and ability disability equity, but you've been focused on, and the work of this team has been focused on, class and financial equity and geographic equity when it comes to access to affordable housing. And so I wanted to come by and tell you how much I appreciate it and how inspiring the work has been. Thank you.
Can I add just one correction? You said your work will be done in 14 months. It's actually 13 months, 3 weeks, and 5 days.
Okay. 13 months, 3 weeks, and 5 days.
I just happen to know because
I also
I've been counting for you, but for accounting for me.
May I say that Dan Saltzman actually just confirmed those numbers.
Yeah.
I'm not
for
sure
both
he,
of us.
I'm not sure he was so focused on either of those numbers. But
I also want to add, if I could, before I part, because I'm no match for you today, let me tell you, or you, or anyone up here, is my thanks to, because part of the separation and the resorting was also on the Portland Development Commission side, and I want to thank Chair Commissioner Molis is here, Chair Andrews was key, Patrick Quinton before him, Bruce Warner. I want to thank you for your good work on all of these things as well. So,
Mayor, before you leave, just so the record is absolutely clear, the 3 years that we have served together were the worst economic downturn in our lifetime. And during that period of time, we launched a new bureau with your full support. We increased funding for homeless services while cutting budgets. We opened Bud Clark Commons, the first of its kind. We expanded our preservation agenda. We created new partnerships. We've had two outstanding bureau directors. And what we've learned along the way is that while we built on a strong foundation that we inherited from people named Stan and Kafori, we knew that we also had to change with the times. And we have both been changing and remodeling the house while also dealing with changed circumstances. And I cannot imagine a more difficult time to be successful in this field. And what I come back to is the people in the trenches who work with us every day and the leadership on this council to make sure that this priority got funded when other things did not. And I want to thank you for that.
And you're just getting going.
So Tracy, with that, let me turn it over to you and to Jacob and your team. And if you could walk us through how we got here and the recommendations, and then we're going to have a bureau presentation to frame up the issue. We have four invited guests who will briefly share their experience. We have some people here who would like to testify. And Madam President, at that point, if we could hold the questions until that's done and then bring back the bureau staff if there's technical questions that people have after they've had the full presentation.
Sounds good.
Tracy, welcome.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Fish. I get to talk about process. But what's wonderful about that is that we did, as Commissioner Fish mentioned, have a lot of assistance in doing this. It's an important process for the Bureau at this time, for Commissioner Fish. It gives us an opportunity to take a look at the policy at a time when we've created a new Bureau, when we're reaffirming our processes and our commitment, and launching a new strategic plan. So the timing for us has been wonderful, and it's been a good opportunity. So the process. So we had a five-month process. We addressed three main questions. Should the policy retain a mandate for a minimum 30% set aside? Should the policy retain spending targets by URA? And were there any improvements that we could make to the mechanism of the policy for budgeting and reporting and the current PHB-PDC relationship? So we did this in three different ways. We had a technical advisory committee, which was PHB staff, PDC staff, and OMF staff. They looked at staffing and overhead, whether that would be subject to the set-aside. They looked at how we account for program income under the set-aside. They looked at a shift from expense-based budgeting to revenue-based budgeting. And finally, a process for adopting exceptions to the set-aside that could be carried out in a time-sensitive way. And so my editorial on this process is I actually was part of the set-aside review at that time as a member of the review committee, as a representative of the Portland Housing Advisory Commission, and as the chair at the time of the Oregon Convention Center Urban Renewal Advisory Committee. And I sat in our first set-aside subcommittee meeting and got the presentation from the technical advisory committee. And my thought at the time was, which I shared with them, it was a very congenial, consensus-based decision-making process. I was struck by how well PHB and PDC staff were working together. It was just something I noticed immediately, and I think that's a really nice sidebar to this process. So that subcommittee that I was serving on was a subcommittee of the Portland Housing Advisory Commission, and there was 11 committee members, including myself. There was another PHAC member, Jesse Beeson of Proud Ground. We had Kimberly Branham from the Portland Development Commission, Peter Pariseau from the Office of Mayor Adams, Kate Allen from the Portland Housing Bureau, John Miller, who is here from Oregon Opportunity Network, Joni Hartman from the Network of Oregon Affordable Housing, Guillermo Maciel from the Office of Chair Kogan, Danielle Ledesma from the Office of Commissioner Fish, Bernie Bottomley from the Portland Business Alliance, and Arlene Kimura from the East Portland Action Plan. So this was this committee did quite a bit of work. We looked at policy targets and whether they needed to be updated for the set-aside, how the policy targets would consider geographic versus citywide needs. Should the set-aside percentage vary among the urban renewal areas? How the policy would be applied to new urban renewal areas, and the best process for amending or updating the policy as needed. So that was the committee that Commissioner Fish referenced that included really a pretty broad group of folks that met a number of times with guidance from staff to really look at those meaty questions that ended up being answered in the document before you. And so part three of the review process was public engagement. And we did that in a couple different ways. Staff went to all six urban renewal advisory committees, and public testimony was accepted at those urban renewal advisory committees. And then in addition, the Portland Housing Advisory Commission had a public hearing on August 2nd that was chaired by Commissioner Fish. So that is all of the, it says 5 months on here, it seemed longer, process that we went through to review the work. And before I introduce Jacob Fox, I also want to give a moment of mention, even though Commissioner Fish did, to my predecessor, who did a lot of the heavy lifting on this that I am now sitting here talking about, Margaret Van Vliet, who initiated this review with Commissioner Fish. And, as I previously mentioned, Danielle Ledesma, who was doing the heavy lifting from Commissioner Fish's office until we stole her away, and she's now the Director of Equity Policy and Communication for the Portland Housing Bureau. So without further ado, Jacob Fox, Deputy Director.
Thanks, Tracy. I appreciate it. Commissioner Fish, fellow commission members, as Tracy talked about, your vision with this policy has really made a difference in our community. And I know we all see it every day. But some of the specifics that you're aware of are that we've invested over $150 million in improving the homes of Portlanders and creating homes for Portlanders. The set-aside expenditures since you created the set-aside have increased. The investment in affordable housing has increased since the set-aside was created and now accounts for 33% of all TIF expenditures. And Commissioner Fish, in his comments, mentioned a few projects, and literally we could sit before you and list many more projects, but our communities are better because of this policy. One of the things that often gets not acknowledged as much as the rental housing development is that TIF is also used to help low-income Portlanders purchase and fix up homes in our communities. And it also helps elderly folks in particular repair their homes so they can continue to live and contribute to our neighborhoods here in Portland. So as Tracy talked about, there are some recommendations before you, and these are recommendations that were built by a broad base of a very diverse group of folks. And I categorize them in two ways. There's the programmatic changes and then some technical recommendations. The programmatic recommendations are well-grounded and pretty straightforward, but the first is just a reaffirmation that the set-aside in our community is important and is a priority for us as leaders in this community. The second is that the development and maintenance of 0 to 30 affordable housing, that targeting our most needy citizens, continues to be a priority for us. And then the third thing is that during these difficult times, as much as we can streamline processes and make things easier for folks that are taking our money and serving the poor, we want to do that while maintaining sort of oversight at the same time. So one of the ways that you'll see this is instead of a separate set-aside report, we will be merging our report about set-aside investments into the PHB annual report. So related to technical recommendations, I would mention a few to you, in that the calculation for set-aside funds is shifting from an expenditure-based to a revenue-based calculation, and that program income, so when we invest in projects and those projects pay us back, instead of it going into a pot that's split between PDC and PHB, funds that PHB invests will come back to PHB. Funds that PDC invests will come back to PDC. And then lastly, our staffing and overhead costs will come out of our 30% for PHB, and staffing and overhead will come out of the 70% for PDC. So those are the programmatic and technical recommendations. It's an honor to serve you, and I believe my job now is to turn it back to Commissioner Fish to introduce our guests.
Thank you, Jacob. And I want to just pick up on something that you said, because I think there's been some confusion about this. The fifth-year review that the council required at, upon adoption was not for the purpose of determining whether this policy would be renewed or not. The policy continues. The purpose of the fifth-year review was to have a sufficient body of evidence to evaluate whether, in fact, it was functioning as intended. And I would just, for those who are new to this, will tell you that one way that we gauge the effectiveness of this program is look at five-year rolling averages. You can't really take a point in time and get a particularly good measurement because of the vagaries of how we spend money and what projects are in the pipeline. A five-year rolling average gives us a better sense of how we're doing. And it was at this time that the council wanted to report back on, you know, what we've accomplished and whether there were any kinds of modifications to strengthen the program. So that's why we're here. So thank you both. We have some invited guests. And I'm going to ask all of you to come forward, if you would, starting with John Miller, the Executive Director of the Oregon Opportunity Network, Steve Messinetti, who is the Executive Director of, Habitat for Humanity, is Elisa, you're here, Elisa Harrigan. Elisa is the Executive Director of the Community Alliance of Tenants. And I'm also going to invite John Mullis to come forward from the Portland Development Commission. And these are our Patrick, are you testifying too?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do these three, and then we'll have you two up. Excuse me. Thank you all for taking time to join us. And Steve, why don't you tee it up?
Great. Steve Messinetti, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity, Portland Metro East. Thanks for having me here. In Habitat, we've been around for 30 years. Serving Portland, but it was just in 2009 that we received our first allocation of TIF funds as a result of a competitive RFP process to build some homes in Lentz. And since then, we've completed 21 homes in the Lentz community with an average TIF amount of $35,000 per home. And we've actually leveraged that now over 400% in just the additional community private investments in those projects. Each home Habitat builds is sold to a family under 60% MFI, which is our policy. But I think it's important to note that these 21 homes in Lentz were sold to families that had an average median income of 41%. And one of the things that TIF has allowed us to do is serve families with lower incomes and to serve more families. Those 21 families, 90% of them are minority families. And Habitat builds family housing. In just those 21 homes live 37 adults and 54 children. So these are 3- and 4-bedroom homes, kids who now are not moving from home to home, but now have the stability that comes with a permanent home. The financial impact is also important to us as an organization, and I think to you all as well. Most of the families we work with are paying tremendous amounts of their income, often over 50%, to their housing before they come to Habitat. And then we require and ensure that once they buy their Habitat home, their payment is less than 30%. And we're able to do this through the zero interest loan program we have. And that has a huge impact immediately on families. The average Habitat mortgage is about $600. The long-term impact is maybe even more significant for our city. These families who typically have no net income going into their first home, within 10 years, assuming no appreciation of that home, the family has at least $50,000 in equity. Again, thanks to that zero interest mortgage, all of their payments in principle go to help build up their own equity. And while housing is not often considered part of economic development, I believe the impact for our city is also significant, not just because these families now have financial stability so they can contribute, but in this case, the 21 homes we've built, over $1.2 million was spent directly to local contractors, over 50 local contractors, and the value of those homes is over $3.2 million, which increases our local tax base as well. And I thought I'd share just a short excerpt of one family who moved into one of our first homes in Lentz, Sandra Aguayo. She says, my name is Sandra Aguayo. My husband, Martin, and I and our three young children used to live in a dilapidated trailer located about a mile from where our new Habitat home is in southeast Portland. The trailer had a leaky roof, wet floors under the carpet. I work in retail and Martin works in a print shop, and we barely made enough to pay the bills and buy food and didn't have anything for the extras. The damp and mold caused our oldest daughter, Sandy, to develop asthma, and her health declined. As her health declined, we knew we needed to find a solution to our housing situation. In 2008, we were accepted into the Habitat program, and in 2009, moved into our new home. When we moved, my daughter, Sandy, was smiling in her room, and she said, "Mom, this feels so good." And I said, "Why?" And she took a deep breath and said, "I can breathe. I can breathe." So I'm mainly here to say that the TIF set-aside works. We see it working in transforming families' lives and believe it works in our communities in providing stability for families and also an investment in our financial future.
Thanks. Steve, thanks very much for joining us. Last year, the team at the Portland Housing Bureau had the opportunity to volunteer a day's service at that Lentz development.
Mm-hmm.
And assignments were made based on people's capacity and their skill set. And I don't know what it says about me that I was asked to measure the windows with a tape measure, but it perhaps kept me out of harm's way. But congratulations on your good work.
Thank you.
John Miller is the executive director of the Oregon Opportunity Network, and it was previously known as?
Community Development Network.
And once upon a time headed by our friend Sam Chase. And this organization was central to the development of the policy and the advocacy for the policy. So, John, thanks for joining us.
You bet. So I'm John Miller, executive director of OregonOn. And yeah, absolutely. Back in 06 and even a little bit before that, as this became an idea and then a reality, we worked very hard at trying to set up the parameters of the program. And I want to thank Commissioner Leonard for carrying a lot of the weight through that process. Did an excellent job in making sure that this program came forward in the way that the community was hoping. And so OregonOn currently has 18 members in the city of Portland. We represent about 12,000 units here in the city. Back in 06, we had very little opportunity to get funds to build. Oftentimes, we were competing with other programs and other initiatives that were out there, especially when it was all the money was within PDC. It was harder to get some of those dollars for affordable housing when there were other economic development activities going on. And oftentimes, the affordable housing would be left out. And thanks to this policy, it's proven to be quite effective, as you can see. $150 million, 33% over the last 5 years. That is as good or better than we had hoped back in 06. And we're excited about the next 5 years and forward. So several projects that have been mentioned today, many of those were developed by our members, probably all of them, frankly. it's just made a huge impact for us and for all of our organizations. One of the it's very difficult to come by flexible funding. A lot of funds that we get from the federal government have strings. Sometimes some money doesn't like to play in the sandbox with other money and so forth. And the TIF set-aside dollars is very flexible, and it can easily be come into projects and fill holes that we can't use other funds for. So that's been really critical. A couple things I wanted to talk about. One of the things, I sat on the committee that created these recommendations, and one of the things that we really strived hard to retain was the minimum, a minimum of 30% to be spent across the city. And that's really critical. And also, along with that, retaining the spending targets in each district. I feel like that was critical as well. One of the things that we've seen nationally in urban renewal often is that areas get redeveloped, but then the folks that lived there before can't afford to live there anymore, and they have to move out. And so, you know, we strongly believe that keeping that minimum in there and doing it by district has been a critical tool in making sure that the displacement, while it doesn't completely eliminate it, it certainly creates opportunity for people to continue to live in the neighborhood once the area has been redeveloped. And I think that's one of the really positive impacts of this tool, and that's why keeping the minimum in place is so critical. As far as the importance of the dollars for 0 to 30, as I mentioned earlier, it's very difficult to find funds to help to build 0 to 30 units. There can really be no debt on a 0 to 30% project. And in order to get to no debt, it's a pretty tough go. One of the things that the TIF set aside dollars has enabled us to do on several projects is actually get to that no debt level and actually effectively build and operate over long term these 0-30 projects. And without the with a focus on the 0-30 with these dollars, it would have been really difficult for us to build and maintain those projects. So I think on behalf of all of our members, and actually as a former CDC operator with host development, and we used these funds as well to develop some houses out in Lentz, we're very pleased with the outcomes of this process. We're thrilled by the first 5 years, and we're looking forward to the next. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John. And before I introduce Elisa, I want to just pick up on something you said, because it's very important, and there's been some confusion, I think, in the last few days about this. We have retained the spending targets and the income guidelines. That has not changed. But you did mention the term minimum, and there's a little bit of a story here that is important that we tell. The focus on a minimum of 30% did not actually come out of the committee's recommendation. The committee did believe that the existing language was sufficient to communicate that intent. And the committee, I think, generally viewed 30% as a floor, not a ceiling, but did not believe that the term minimum needed to be included in the presentation. When the recommendations came to the director and me for review, we felt that since this document was designed to survive this council and guide future councils, we thought it was important to explicitly put the term minimum back in, not because we didn't think the committee intended that, but we thought that the language needed to be there so that it was unmistakably clear. The term minimum is in the proposal that is before council. It evidences my belief that the 30% was intended to be a floor, not a ceiling. It does not compel council to spend more than 30%, but it is an important philosophical marker, and that was put back into the recommendation by the director and the commissioner in charge. Thanks very much. Elisa Harrigan is the executive director of the Community Alliance of Tenants, and the other night, Dan Saltzman and I had the pleasure of joining her for their annual meeting and dinner. And Dan received a low-income housing champion award for his work with building inspectors in our community. And I was honored to receive an award for our work on fair housing. And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Elisa Harrigan. I'm the executive director of the Community Alliance of Tenants. Our mission is to educate and empower tenants' demand for safe, stable, and affordable housing. CAT has approximately 2,000 members and about 800 supporters in the Portland area. And in general, nearly half of the residents in Portland are renters. I feel it's really important to mention about how many people were impacting with this. We came to council with our allies and partners just over 5 years ago. I was here often coming and doing testimony and coming and seeing many of you with residents who were struggling with their housing needs in being doubled up and tripled up in their homes because there wasn't enough affordable housing. Over the years, we've been tough to please, particularly in affordable housing, because it impacts us so much as members, as staff at CAT, and board members of the Community Alliance of Tenants. We have all been impacted by these issues, not just by people we are helping, but us individually. And so the TIF set-aside has been important to us. The 30%, getting to that part that we can talk about it as a minimum, is huge, because before it wasn't even part of the conversation. It was such a struggle to get to that point. CAT and other agencies like 211, we are the ones on the ground fielding calls from distressed renters in the community who are having to make those terrible choices about going into homelessness or what they do. They're at their wits' end, and they're at the very end. And if they call us, unfortunately, towards the middle or the end of the month, we don't have very much good news to tell them. So we are the ones who are dealing with, you know, the cries, the tears, trying to give them any tips and strategies on how to resolve this. A few years ago, the burden was a little bit worse. It's eased up as we're seeing more units being built in inner Portland. As we were seeing our members being pushed out to Gresham and Beaverton, we were pleased to start seeing the construction of Block 49. Bud Clark Commons, Shaver Green Apartments, where we're seeing our members going back into Inner Portland and being able to go back into their communities. So this is a huge delight. We are going to continue to work as advocates to hold city staff members and council to the numbers that are measured in the policy. This is essential. These homes, you know, we talked about it 5 years ago. In order for hardworking families and children to succeed, they need a place to call home. It makes a difference with hunger relief, with the success of children in schools. So this is vitally important, you know, and it's not a renewal, but I would say it's a recommitment to moving forward in this and having that investment moving forward. We need to invest in housing in order to invest in our communities and the success of Portland's richness and diversity. Our members thank everybody who's participated in making this happen. We've seen great success, particularly in the later years. We're finally feeling the burden lessen a little bit. And so we can't wait to see what's going to happen in the next 5 years and to see more of these units going up. And that the intent originally that was passed 5 years ago continues to move forward. Thank you.
Lisa and Steve and John, thanks very much for joining us today. Madam President, we have two more invited guests, and that will then conclude our formal presentation. We're joined by Patrick Quinton, the Executive Director of the Portland Development Commission, and John Mullis, a distinguished commissioner of the PDC. Gentlemen, thank you for taking time to join us this afternoon, and I'll let you decide who goes first.
I'll start it off. Thank you, Commissioner Fish and fellow commissioners. And yes, Commissioner Mullis and I wanted to join you today just to voice our support for adopting the new policy. And in fact, our commission is meeting shortly to review and hopefully adopt the same policy. So we'll make our remarks brief and we'll head off to our board meeting. I was just going to start off and just talk a little bit about the relationship that I think Commissioner Fish and as well Tracy and Jacob have mentioned. We truly do enjoy a great relationship with the Portland Housing Bureau, and I think if I was to channel our board chair, Scott Andrews, he would say that back in 2006 and then in 2009 when the Portland Housing Bureau was created, there was a lot of consternation about what this would do to PDC. And I think now, in hindsight, we can see how not only effective the set-aside has been in achieving the city's affordable housing goals, but also how effective the separation of the two entities has been. And so I think it's, you know, it just, I think we'll make the next 5 years even more effective. And we look forward to working with PHB and Commissioner Fish during that time. And then on the process, I know Tracy was stuck with talking about the process, but we do just want to congratulate PHB and your staff, Commissioner Fish, on a thoughtful process. We were involved along the way. We had significant involvement in the technical committee, and the technical stuff matters. And I can tell you, the people who administer the set aside on both from both bureaus, both our agency and PHB, are very happy with the technical changes. They're the ones who live with the accounting all the time. And on the stakeholder side, Kimberly Brannon was our representative, and I think she felt like the conversations were very productive and earnest, and as you mentioned, we reached common ground. So we look forward to the next 5 years and appreciate the great working relationship that we have. And with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Mullis.
John, hey, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, President Fritz and commissioners. Pleased to be here. I actually had some talking points, and some of them were a number of the projects, or actually I think all of the projects that have been built since this policy was enacted, and since a number of them have already been referred to, I'm going to take a little bit of a different tact. I've been on the PDC board for about 5 years now, so it's been very interesting to watch how the TIF policy has gone into effect, all the projects that it's funded. I think the differences in people's lives that have been articulated by the earlier guests. I was going to speak briefly to the good relationship that we've enjoyed over the past several years, but I think Patrick has done that very well, so I won't go there. I guess I'll just close real quickly, because we have a board meeting very shortly, just by saying that one of the projects that I think you mentioned earlier, Commissioner Fish, is the Blanche A House, and that's just coming out of the ground right now, literally. And so it's always good to see construction workers going back to work. You mentioned the very difficult economic times that we've been in for the past 3 years, and the Bud Commons project, the Ramona project, a number of these other projects that have occurred in the last 3 years probably have literally made the difference between some of these construction workers hanging onto their own homes. So it's very meaningful for the clients that they serve. It's also been very meaningful for the people in the building trades that have had the good fortune to work on these projects over the past 3 years. I took a tour of the transition project where the folks were before Bud Commons opened. And I can't remember the cross streets. I should. I know Tracy would know. But folks were in a room this size with bunk beds, literally in a hallway from here to that table. When folks that weren't in the facility came in for showers, they walked through those folks' living areas and then back out. I took a tour of the Bud Commons when it was in the finished stages, and what a beautiful facility that it is. I couldn't make the ribbon cutting and the moving in ceremony, unfortunately, but what a difference that it certainly has to be making for the folks that are in that facility and the other ones that we've talked about. So just pleased to be a part of this. Thank you, Commissioner Fish, for your leadership. Mayor Adams had the good sense to go home before he hopefully infected all of you, but I know he worked hard on it, and all your staffs who lots of times don't get enough credit. So thanks very much.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. That concludes our formal presentation. I think there's some people signed up to testify.
Thank you. And I would just like to mention, as the PDC folks are leaving, that I concur with their assessment about the importance of the set-aside, which was done for the right reasons and has proven even more worthy in these tough times while people really needed affordable housing and construction workers needed to keep working on housing projects. So thank you very much. Please call the first three.
We have two people who signed up, Claire Corwin-Kordowski and Susan Emmons.
Why don't you both come forward if you could?
Welcome to City Council Chambers. We just need your first and last names. We don't need your address. If you are testifying on behalf of a lobbying entity, we need to know that. And then you have 3 minutes each, and the clock in front of you helps you count down.
All right. I'm Claire Corwin-Kordowski, and I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Portland. The League has a long history of involvement in both urban renewal and affordable housing, and actively participated in the 2006 set-aside policy discussions. For the most part, we're pleased with the draft policy under consideration today. We strongly support maintaining the 30% set-aside as a minimum and continuing the annual reporting utilizing the established income guidelines. State statute requires that urban renewal plans and TIF, tax increment financing expenditures for each district, comply with the city's comprehensive plan. According to that plan, housing in redevelopment areas should be affordable to household incomes reflective of the city as a whole. The set-aside resources are not sufficient to meet the standard, but they do ensure that a credible effort is made in each district. It appears the city is abandoning the 30% set-aside requirement for individual urban renewal areas. If this is so, we are concerned that some will not comply with this provision. We fear pressure will be exerted to spend the set-aside dollars on housing east of I-205 or in North Portland because it is challenging to develop low-cost housing in the central city. By retaining the specific targets and creating housing for those most in need within each district, families and individuals of all incomes will have the opportunity to benefit from the increased attention and public investment that takes place within the boundaries of an urban renewal area. In light of the fact that demand far outstrips supply for units affordable to households earning below 30% of median family income, we urge you to include a statement in the policy identifying development of those units as a priority. Some have suggested that set-aside resources be spent on student and middle-income workforce housing. TIF funds typically are combined with money from other sources that limits access to students. In light of the scarcity of low-income housing funds, the city must invest in a way that maximizes the use of outside resources. Furthermore, we acknowledge the desire for middle-income households to have more housing options, particularly in the central city. However, given the tremendous need among the lowest-income families and workers for safe and decent housing, we believe meeting their needs should come first. Finally, we would like to thank Council for its commitment to affordable housing and Commissioner Fish for his leadership.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Susan Emmons. I'm the director of Northwest Pilot Project. When I came to work this morning, there were 14 people in our lobby. We had the staff and appointment slots to serve four. We serve very low-income men and women age 55 and over. We help with emergency, transitional, and permanent housing, and we touch the lives of about 3,000 people each year. The greatest need of the people who come to our doors is an affordable place to live. I've been in my job for 26 years. Every needs assessment that the city has done tells us the same thing. The greatest housing need in our community is for people who have an income of 30% of median family income or less. I'm sharing with you Northwest Pilot Project's 2011 downtown Portland housing inventory. In spite of adding the Bud Clark Commons, in spite of Commissioner Fish and the exceptional job that you have done in the city in preservation, we continue to lose ground. And you have done an exceptional job in preservation. We really appreciate it. We believe the same loss is seen in neighborhoods across the city. We're never going to end homelessness in Portland if we don't reverse this trend. On page 4 of the packet I'm giving you, you'll see a chart comparing renter households and availability of units in Portland. The only category of low-income renters that has a shortage of units is the 0 to 30% of median income range. This chart needs to be updated, but we believe the deficit is over 12,000 units citywide. We support maintaining the 30% set aside as a minimum and continuing the annual reporting, utilizing the established income guidelines. It's great that you've done that. But we think that you should include an additional statement in the policy that prioritizes development of housing for people at 30% of median family income or less. It's easier to make the deals pencil for those at 60% of MFI, but that isn't where the greatest need lies in our community. These resources are an exceptional opportunity to respond to an unmet need in our community, and we strongly urge you to include unit goals in the proposal you adopt. We have to be able to understand what we can accomplish with this resource. The city has made a strong commitment to equity, and this can be a first step towards addressing the housing inequity that exists in our city. Housing is fundamental to achieving equity, and we will never get there as a city until we can say that we have rental housing affordable to all of our citizens. In terms of the geographic distribution, I'd just like to say that I believe in the goals of the comprehensive plan and our original vision that housing created in urban renewal areas will match the city's income profile. In 2011, 14% of the citizens of Portland have incomes of 0 to 30% of MFI. If we're really interested in equity, the way to have our urban renewal areas benefit all of our citizens is to prioritize developing housing for the poorest of the poor. And again, South Waterfront is great, but we're getting 42 units. We have over 42 units out of that building will be affordable to people at 0 to 30% of median income. And there are over 2,000 units in South Waterfront. We're getting 42.
Susan, before we lose you, because it's a treat to have you before council.
Okay, thank you.
If I could make a comment and ask a question.
Okay.
We don't have the time here today, but Susan has the best Mark Hatfield story I've ever heard. And probably all of us have heard it in different versions, but it has something to do with her being in a bathtub and getting a phone call late at night from someone who had just come off the Senate floor to do something that Susan had been the prime advocate for, which was replacement dollars for lost housing downtown through, I guess, the development of the courthouse. And I have had the pleasure of your presentations when I was on the board of then the Housing Authority of Portland and now as the Housing Commissioner. Today I learned from our lobbying team that the proposed cuts that may come out of Washington on both the HOME program and CDBG, and including some caps on the so-called administrative cap question, which would bring us from 20% to 10%, are going to have a significant impact on our ability to use that flexible resource to do our preservation agenda. I've mentioned before that the TIF cliff is going to mean that we're going to have fewer TIF dollars. You and I know that this work gets even harder in a tight rental market because rents go up, and there's also the temptation that people are inclined because of market forces to develop more units at those higher rates than at the 0 to 30. Do you have a suggestion or two in addition to your testimony for things that you would like this council to think about over the next year through the budget process and in our strategic work about other financing mechanisms, creative ideas where we can meet our shared goal of providing homes for low-income seniors and families?
I guess I would just say that I think there's this tendency to build for the upper end of poverty because we can get more units. And I understand it takes a deep, deep subsidy to build for people at 30% of median or less, but that's where our need is. And I would say we should go for fewer units. I think we have to much more closely align with Home Forward, our housing authority. I think they can bring project-based subsidy. I know it's tight, but I don't think we tried hard enough in South Waterfront. I understand that was before your time. I think instead of getting a building of 209 units where we have 42 units at 30%, I think we could have gotten many more units in that building. And again, I think you got the best deal you could get, what you inherited. But I think we need to be much more thoughtful about how we partner. But I think there is this tendency to build for a population that, at least according to the needs assessments and the numbers we have, we actually have an excess of units for those people. So, and I think that it's a hard message, but I think that we need to build for the people in greatest need.
And what I will tell you is that while our strategic plan that we've just developed focuses on 0 to 30. And focuses on the
group. It's wonderful. I appreciate it.
That you've championed. What I will tell you that's frustrating for us is the kind of federal cuts that are being contemplated are precisely the dollars which we use to subsidize those deeply affordable units. And so as TIF declines, which is our ability to build units, and our federal funds, which is our ability to buy down and subsidize units, we're kind of getting hit with a double whammy. And it may be a case not so much of a lack of will, but the challenge of putting the financing together. I will tell you, though, that your comment about better alignment with Home Forward strikes a chord with me around Section 8 vouchers. And I know you've been fighting this good fight for a long time. There's a tension, as my colleagues know, in the Section 8 world between housing choice, which is you get a voucher and decide where you want to live, and project base, which parks it in a building, undercutting a little bit of the choice, but creating a permanently or semi-permanently affordable unit. In our preservation work, we want to maintain project-based subsidies because we want those units to be affordable for 20 years. It doesn't necessarily help our community to give someone who's been kicked out of their unit a Section 8 voucher because they may move to another state, they may move out of our community, they may lose the voucher for administrative reasons. It's a much better investment to keep it in the unit. But I appreciate your comment that we may want to be thinking about better alignment with our housing authorities to use those vouchers in a project base. And I think that's a point well taken.
And I would just say as a specific example, with Home Forward, they're building the Peter Paulson that was the first replacement housing for the courthouse. When we opened, it was affordable to our folks. We have taken it out of our inventory because it now rents for $490 a month. You know, and so to me, is there a creative way to look at those? Is there a way that some tax increment, and maybe not a lot, could have drawn down the debt on that publicly held building? I mean, I compared those units to a parking space. It's still a wonderful building, but they're studio units for 171 square feet that rent for $490 a month. And so if there was some way of creatively thinking, could we get that rent down to $425? We can get our folks into it. They can't afford it at $490. So it's just, there just may be some creative things that we haven't been
thinking of. I know Tracy's having lunch with you next week, and we really want to go a little deeper on that and strategize. So thank you both for being here.
And thank you for your leadership on this. It is an important policy, and I appreciate all the remarks that were made.
Thank you. Let's have our team back. Tracy, I have a question. My colleagues may, and then we'll bring this to closure. I want to ask you, Tracy, or Jacob, about something that's in the prepared testimony for League of Women Voters, because I believe there's been some confusion on this point. And the person who testified said that it appears that there's been an abandonment of the 30% set-aside requirement for individual urban renewal areas. And I want to clarify the record on that. And I'll tell you my understanding, and you can tell me if I've got this right. The proposal before council maintains the targets that were established in 2006 by district. And those targets recognize that not every district is made the same, and some districts have less developable dirt, fewer opportunities. So, for example, the Oregon Convention Center was pegged at 26%, and the Central East Side was pegged at a lower rate. Overall, in 2006, the aggregate had to be 30% or higher. My understanding is